For me, I was like, okay, we will deal with it. And my partner as well, who's a physician and who knew how serious it was. I didn't even know that 88% of people with stage 4 colon cancer are basically dying, but she knew. But she, of course, was extremely supportive throughout. And then my daughter, who of course didn't know what was going on and expected her daddy to be acting the same way, even if I got chemotherapy earlier in the day. And so how could I not act the same way?
So how does it feel to be part of the 12%?
It feels good. And of course, I'd like to continue to be in that 12%.
Well, it is a pleasure to spend this time with you. And we look forward to interviewing you in your book when it comes out this summer.
Thank you.
Ibram X. Kendi, professor of history and international relations, founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much.
What's going on, guys? This is Luke Paul, and I got a show Saturday nights from 6 to 8 p.m. called Punk Show, where I play and give you history on the entire punk genre, from bands that started it all to new and unbecoming bands. So tune in Saturday nights from 6 to 8 p.m. to Punk Show on 89.3 FM. Hope you dig it.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio. From the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn.
Good afternoon. It's the WHFR Journal here at 89.3, also online at WHFR.fm. I'm Alan Mazurek, along with Susan McGraw, welcoming you back for another Friday afternoon of discussion of things going on here on the HSC campus, in the Dearborn community, and I guess in the world at large, at least as we wrap up this Valentine's week. But we'll get to that in just a moment.
Look forward to it. One thing I am not loving, and that is this weather, Alan.
It's been another up and down week. Really, hasn't it?
To say the least. Well, we hope and expect that our listeners are safe and doing the right thing and being not only aware but also cautious. I know as an instructor, I have had a few students here and there when we have had school email or text or something and say, my car's not going to make it. I'm sorry. It's not going to make it. It's not going to make it. And I respect that. I really
sure.
do. We have to know our limits as citizens and so on. But we are, you know, we're doing the best we can. Interesting. Communities are doing the best they can as well.
Right.
Hearing a little grumbling about tickets being given out during snow emergencies and not enough salting in the different roadways and so on. But I suppose we should at least share some of the basics if you are a resident of Dearborn or the Dearborn Heights area. Some slight differences, but do know that although every community is trying to do the best they can to make sure that their residents are safe, oftentimes getting to everybody very quickly is not always the case. In particular, like we had early in the week with that the freezing rain and all, there's not much you can do about that. You know, it sort of has to happen, and then you sort of dig out after that. But it's been tough. So relating to snow emergencies, particularly in the city of Dearborn, do understand that if a vehicle is parked in the street and it's considered a snow emergency time, mm-hmm. as dedicated by the city of Dearborn, you're going to get a ticket if you leave your vehicle on the street. Tickets are $80. That's not something to sneeze at, for sure.
Well, I can go better than $80. A new law which took effect in Michigan on Wednesday, which again, you know, given the amount of traffic problems that we've had in and around Metro Detroit area, a new state law which mm-hmm. was signed into law by Governor Snyder at the end of his term took effect just a couple of days ago, and it involves moving over and slowing down to 10 miles an hour under posted speed limits to go around emergency vehicles. Mm. This comes in the wake of, and there have been numerous reports about this, you know, multiple instances that where Michigan State Police vehicles or emergency workers have had their cars or have themselves been hit. In fact, there was another story about how Ford Motor Company is providing a new, like, beefed-up Explorer patrol cruiser, which will survive a rear impact up to 75 miles per hour, which is a big improvement. But the idea being is that, you know, the people that are out there trying to help stranded motorists or even doing their job pulling people over who have had other, you know, who, you know, were speeding or were involved in accidents are putting their lives, you know, at stake. So new state law, which includes a fine of a $400 $10 ticket will require you, according to Senate Bill 0447, which was signed into law by Governor Snyder last year, to slow down to 10 miles per hour below the posted speed limit and move to a new lane when passing an authorized emergency vehicle. And I suppose that could mean perhaps a tow truck, perhaps, you know, one of those courtesy vans that are there to help people change tires, and obviously police vehicles on the road as well.
What about salt trucks? What about plows? Things like that, would you say?
I don't know if that's specifically addressed in the law. Okay. When we have, you know, obviously, if the salt truck is there in the middle lane or the plow truck is in the left lane, obviously, you know that they're going to be driving slower than maybe some people want to go. I don't know if it's covered in this law, but it's certainly covered by common sense.
That law,
just slow
law
down and be
sense.
Safe, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no doubt about it. Interestingly, you might think that you've got common sense and that you're, you know, oh, the snow emergency is over. I just got home from work. I didn't move my vehicle. I realized that I'm just going to leave it. Well, did you know that at least here in the city of Dearborn, police can still give tickets to parked vehicles that look like they weren't moved during a snow emergency, like they're still all covered with snow kind of a thing, or the plow that came by sort of boxed them in. So you still want to get that vehicle moved as soon as possible.
Something else that's going to be here before you know it, and we mentioned it briefly on last week's program, the HFC Music Department's 24th Annual President's Collage Concert taking place next Saturday. That's Saturday evening at the Guido Theater at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center. It's an annual tradition that began in the mid-1990s with the support of Dr. Andrew Mazzara, then the president of the college, and it's sort of like taken on a life of its own. It celebrates HFC's vibrant music program, the largest two-year ensemble program in Michigan, by the way, and HFC music directors bring together the choral and instrumental ensembles for a varied and exciting performance. In all, it will include over 250 performers that will take the stage sometime in the course of about an hour and a half next Saturday evening over at the Guido Theater at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center on Michigan Avenue. Tickets are $18 per person. You can purchase them at the box office next week. You can also get them online at DearbornTheater.com, and more information is available at the HFC website, which is hfcc.edu. Let's see, we're going to have two jazz bands. The Henry Ford Big Band in Studio 110 will also have a concert band. The Metropolitan Symphony Band will have two vocal jazz ensembles, Blue Fusion and Midnight Blue, a women's choral ensemble, Renaissance Voices, and two mixed choirs, HFC Chorus and Vanguard Voices. So that's coming up next Saturday. Hopefully the weather is good, and you'll be able to work your way there for that performance.
Very nice. We have just gotten word that WHFR also, and I'm bragging a little bit, but we will be doing a live presentation, a live broadcast of the very exciting Arty Party coming up the first Thursday in April, which is really the kickoff to April Arts Month, as we know it here in the community. Now, next month, we're going to be having Emma Jean Woodyard in. To tell us all about all the exciting things going on, but we sort of just officially got word about that presentation of the event officially taking place on Thursday the 4th, and we at WHFR are going to be a part of it. So start thinking arts if you're just overwhelmed with this wintry mix that's going on. Think about what's coming. Think about the spring and the music and the art that this great community has to offer, and we're excited to be a part of that kickoff. Details to come soon, of course.
Now, before we move to what is, for most of us, a decidedly wonderful topic to talk about, being Valentine's Week, that's love, one other serious issue that we want to talk about, and something that is addressing it here on the Henry Ford College campus. There was, and it's no secret, I saw an article earlier this week from the Washington Post about Kingsley, Michigan, a little town just south of Traverse City, that in the course of the last last 8 or 9 months has had to deal with 3 suicides by teenagers in their school systems. And there is no secret that at this point in time, suicide is the second leading cause of death of teenagers and people really up until their mid-20s. Truly a crisis, and a lot of people are, and as the article addressed, trying to grapple with why and how it happens. And there is an event that's taking place next Thursday here at the Henry Ford campus, which is a suicide prevention information session. And it's based around 3 simple steps. Now, being a soccer fan, when I see QPR, I think Queen's Park Rangers, which is a British soccer team. But in this case, for suicide prevention, it means question, persuade, and refer. 3 simple steps that anyone can learn to help save a life from suicide. It's an information session conducted by staff from Wayne County to learn these 3 vital steps to recognizing the warning signs of a suicide crisis and to join thousands of Americans who've learned how to question, persuade, and refer someone to help. It is being co-sponsored by the Office of Campus Safety, the Office of Student Activities, and the Office of Student Compliance and Title IX. It's open to the public. More information available on hfcc.edu. It takes place Thursday, next Thursday, February 21st, from 3 to 5 o'clock at the Barry Amphitheater at the Mazara Administrative Services and Conference Center here, Building L, here on the HFC campus.
Such an important topic. And there are a lot of very wonderful organizations that support awareness of things, signs, warning signs to look for, things to talk with young people about, and so on. But I'm so appreciative that that this effort is being made here locally to help get the word out about such an important topic. Our young people are facing a lot, there's no doubt about it, and any opportunity to help and be a guide and a support is important. You know, that's one way to show love, by reaching out and certainly certainly helping to be a catalyst for positive change or you know, change a mood. Sometimes changing an environment in a short term can really bring somebody from one aspect of their life to another. Since we've just gone through sort of the season of love, or we are in the season of love, of course. That's
yes, correct.
It's a wonderful thing. I know we're going to have some reflection on a variety of different love topics. Ryan Scholler will be joining us, an encore presentation of his discussion on different types of love. Yes.
We'll also have a TED Talk about the foolproof method of maybe you're not trying to fall in love. We'll let you listen for that one coming up later. Yeah.
Very nice. Yep. Very nice. But I have to think, you know, this past week we had the very high profile passing and then funeral here locally at Dearborn's Divine Child Catholic Church of Congressman John Dingell, the longest serving congressional member in the United States. And I was just always taken with the love affair that he and his beautiful wife Debbie had over the years. And his passing caused me to do a little more research on how the two of them met, how they got together, and so on. And I just think that it you know, it's sort of like anything is possible. They were married 38 years, and the information that I gathered indicated that it took him 17 tries asking her out before she finally said yes. I think that's dedication. So he was certainly tenacious, if nothing else, in his love experience.
Well, those who knew him politically would certainly agree that he was very tenacious for things that he believed in.
No doubt.
And obviously, yes, he was, 27 years, her senior, somewhere around 25 years older than her. But for some reason, that relationship worked. She wrote a very, very moving, and it was, you know, posted through a lot of local media outlets. Facebook post last week, Saturday, I think it was, Saturday morning, just shortly after John had died, that really, you know, laid out sort of, you know, his last days, and also laid bare, you know, exactly how she felt and the love that was a part of their relationship.
Oh, yeah. He always called her the lovely Deborah, and anytime I didn't have the pleasure of seeing them both together, but seeing them separately, and Debbie Dingell is a strong supporter of Henry Ford College, and she's been on our station a number of times and so on, so she's just a wonderful advocate in our community. But ultimately, just hearing more about sort of the way they came together and so on, it just makes you really feel strongly about the concept of the power of love and how things, you know, people maybe are just meant to be brought together under the craziest of circumstances. She was a staunch Republican, of course. He a strong Democrat. Again, you mentioned the age difference and so many other aspects. And he was a big game hunter, which was not her thing. Very strong NRA advocate, which she, as a as a Republican at the time, liked. And then they got into some issues when the NRA started sort of changing its focus. And ultimately, when all was said and done, 38 years later, you know, actually 40 years at this point later in their relationship, you can look at this couple and say what a loving, loving experience they had together, and what an impact they had on so many other people due to the respect and the nurturing and the a little bit of give and take that it takes to make a relationship work. So I just love that love affair, and they called it a love affair too for all of their years together. And the one thing I thought that was interesting, right after they got married, I guess that's when she flipped from Republican to Democrat. So I who knows what that was all of, what those conversations were like. But she was, of course,
The part of compromise that comes into a relationship,
no
right?
No doubt about it. But certainly what those words meant 30 years ago or 40 years ago versus what they mean today is maybe a different story in general. But just a wonderful testament to love and true love, and that the fairy tale can exist, and it does. And so many of us are lucky enough to have a special someone in our lives. And we just, as silly as it sounds, it is something we're celebrating and being proud of and excited about.
Well, and I think anybody, politics aside, can, obviously wish her the best going through this difficult phase in her life, yet also still, being a representative, a member of Congress, representing this this area, this community, on a national level as well. So, yes.
No doubt about it. Our thoughts and prayers and wishes go out to the entire family, certainly. I was by the church early in the week for the funeral. I didn't go in. I knew how crowded it was going to be, and it was. I couldn't even get a parking spot. But the way the Dearborn community handled it, I have to say, the Dearborn mayor, Dearborn Police and Fire Department, it was a very well-executed process, and we only heard wonderful things about the way everything was treated. It was very emotional, very moving. If you probably maybe saw it in the paper on the news about the fire trucks that had the big American flag hoisted up just in front of the church, I saw that from a distance. You couldn't miss it. It was just very prominent, very profound. So kudos to the city for really managing all that very, very well.
All right, let's get to the subject at hand. Let's talk about love. Let's move on to the next segment of the WHFR Journal. How about that?
Sounds
what
great.
Do we got coming up?
Ryan Scholler joining us next. He is a philosophy instructor for several years here at Henry Ford College, and we had the chance to talk with him not too long ago about his take on love, what it actually means. And I remember hearing this interview for the first time and noting from it the most important component of the term I love you is the letter I, or the word I. So listen for that. It's fascinating.
Well, I hope you will stick around. After the break, we'll be back with more of the WHFR Journal.
Henry Ford College Theater collaborators are taking the show on the road. HFC adjunct theater instructor Jerry Zablinski is producing a 2-hour modern dress production of Shakespeare's Hamlet, February 8th through 17th at Concordia University in Ann Arbor. The production is sponsored by the Kreft Arts Program in collaboration with the Experimental Performing Arts Association. The play's director, lighting designer, and 6 of the actors are all HFC alumni. Visit cuaa.edu/events. For more info.
the WHFR Journal here at the station Making Waves. I'm Alan Mazurek along with Susan McGraw. Each week we bring you a variety of stories and topics that we, behind the scenes at least, find interesting. Now we're going to talk about probably the most interesting subject of all. The one that we're all looking for in life, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about love, right?
Absolutely.
All right.
And love is a many splendid thing. I didn't write that.
So I hear that. Yeah.
We are very happy and excited to be joined in studio today. First time in our studio, so welcome to Dr. Ryan Scholler, who is in the philosophy department here at, he is the philosophy department here at Henry Ford College, and is just, it's been a pleasure to know you and to get to see more of what you do on a regular basis with the concept of philosophy, and really excited to have you here, in particular, Ryan, under this topic of love. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
Certainly. We speak of love in a very romantic way. This literally is our theme for this particular week. We do theme weeks periodically at WHFR. So all of our shows from this past Sunday through tomorrow will be in some way having to have a connection to love, whether it's romantic love or self-love or love of a particular thing that we haven't established yet or whatever the case, love of the world, love of the universe, the environment. Most of us tend to think of, we see the hearts, we see the chocolates, and we just think romantic love. But from a philosophical standpoint and an academic standpoint, it really is so much more than that. Tell us
certainly.
A little bit about it.
Oh, yeah, certainly. So I think it's really interesting that the word philosophy itself already contains love in it. It's made up of two different Greek words. This philo part at the beginning is actually one of the Greek words for love. The Greeks had a lot of different words for love. English is sort of a simple language in a lot of senses. We tend to subsume a lot of different concepts under one word, and so we use love, like you said, to talk about a lot of different things. But the Greeks were well aware that there's a lot of different types of love, and so they had different words for the different kinds of love, and this philo is one of them. It's where we get this file ending on a lot of words, such as an Anglophile, a lover of English, a Francophile, a lover of French.
At a radio station, we say audiophile.
Audiophile, yes, certainly, certainly.
We love high-quality audio.
And then there's darker words, such as pedophilia is related to it. And then one that I just ran into thinking about this was hemophilia, which literally means a lover of blood, which is actually a medical condition where the blood doesn't properly clot, so when a person's injured, they bleed profusely. And so it's a really weird use of the word love there, that they don't actually probably love the bleeding. But so that this beginning part of the word philosophy is literally about love. So philosophy has been engaged in the concept of love since its inception. The other half of the word, the sophie part, is the Greek word for wisdom. And so if you know anybody who's named Sophia or Sophie, they're literally named wisdom. And so philosophy then in its beginning is literally the love of wisdom, and a philosopher would be a lover of wisdom. And this sounds a little weird on the surface, but I think if you think about it a little bit, the way philosophers are portrayed in the ancient Greek tradition, especially by Plato, they're seen as these people who have fallen in love with the pursuit of truth and wisdom and knowledge. And there were these other guys in ancient Greece that we call the sophists or the sophists, and they were sort of they're excellent orators, and you could hire them to argue your case in court. You could hire them to train your children in the art of persuasion, things like that. And their name, sophist, is that second half of the philosophy word, but it's missing the love component. So at least the way Plato portrays them, that their main goal was material gain, and they were missing this actual love of wisdom in the pursuit of wisdom. And it's interesting to me too that pursuit is always there in the concept of love from the beginning of the philosophical tradition as well. I think about the concept of falling in love. If you've ever fallen in love before, it's a really weird experience. It's very strange. First of all, it seems to be thrust on you almost against your will, not against your will, but without your will. We pass by people every day. We interact with people every day. But then suddenly, as if out of nowhere, there's this one person that becomes this unique object of our affection. And really weird things happen to us. You know, we become almost obsessed with them. We can't think about anything else. Everything else in our life just seems to sort of fade away into insignificance. You know, we forget to eat. We can't sleep. We're completely consumed by thoughts about this person. And hence the falling in love. It's something that just seems to happen to you. And in a lot of ways, it's wonderful. But in a lot of ways, it's also kind of painful, and you know, it's been described as a sickness. We talk about people being sick in love and love sick. You might have a family member or a friend ask you, "Are you feeling okay? Is everything all right?" They see the symptoms of the illness, right? And yeah, probably the appropriate answer is, "I don't know. I don't know if I'm all right. Something weird is happening to me. I think I'm okay, but I'm not exactly sure." So the ancient Greek philosophers were portrayed this way. They're sort of these people who had this experience, but it was an experience with truth and wisdom and knowledge, and everything else in their lives sort of faded into insignificance, and they're obsessed with the pursuit of this object of their affection. So philosophy is inherently about love, and there's plenty that it has to say about the topic of romantic love as well.
Interesting. When we get into the nitty-gritty of the discussion of love, wow, again, you've gone very deep very quickly, but I'm glad you did, because we don't have a lot of time.
I was going to say, let's review. We've got philosophist, that's which right. is love of knowledge. Yep. We've got sophist, I thought, was one, which right. was, just break that down for
they're
us
like
again.
Wisdomists. They're wisdomists without go. The love, right?
All right. Let's
what
see,
fun
then.
Is that?
Now, they trade in wisdom. They what, sell wisdom.
What's our phrase for romantic love?
Well,
falling
so,
in love?
Yeah.
I thought there was a word there.
Well, you know, the Greeks had another word for romantic love, which is eros, which we know we get our word erotic
sure.
from it. And so romantic love would usually be under the heading of eros. And I think there's a really fascinating dialogue that Plato writes called the Symposium. And in this dialogue, Socrates and several other influential Greeks are at a banquet. The word symposium literally means drinking banquet. They all would get together and they would drink a lot, and they'd make these speeches. About
I've had
things.
My share of those.
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of like a truth serum type thing, right, where they would say things they wouldn't ordinarily say, and sometimes they were really profound, sometimes they were ridiculous. But these different characters got up and gave speeches about eros. And two really important ones, I think. One of them is the famous Greek playwright Aristophanes. He's one of them, and he gets up and he tells a story about this idea that when the gods created humans in the beginning, they actually created them as sort of dual persons. So you'd have two people sort of together with their faces facing away from each other. And sometimes it'd be two males, sometimes it'd be two females, sometimes it'd be a male-female combination. And these creatures, they got really powerful. And so the gods decided to cut them in half and separate them from each other, and then so they spent the rest of their lives trying to find that part that had been removed from them. This is where we get the whole phrase, you know, the other half, or even soulmate comes from this. And so again, the pursuit element is there. And I think this is where we get things like, you know, there's this famous line in the Jerry Maguire movie that you complete me, the idea of you know, love as I'm missing something. Is inherent in that. And then Socrates eventually gets up and does a speech, and he's actually relaying some ideas that were given to him by this woman named Diadema, who's a priestess and a philosopher. And he really builds on this idea of pursuit, and he talks about how we're drawn to he says that Eros, the god Eros, the parents of the god Eros, were lack and resourcefulness. Lack, so a sense of missing something, a sense of needing something to complete you, but then also this resourcefulness, this sort of craftiness that allows you to pursue it. And so anyway, Socrates, you know, sort of presents this idea of falling in love as me being confronted with an object of affection that in a sense I feel would complete me. But once I actually possess it, that's the goal in the beginning, the pursuit. And resourcefulness is what you use to possess it. I think I'm going to be happy once I possess this thing. But like the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer says, possession takes away the charm. Eventually, I think in the beginning of a relationship, that there's this. It's almost like a drug. It's magical. There's a charm there. But of course, inevitably, that has to fade. It can't be like you couldn't stand having it like that for the rest of your life. And
we'd like to try, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's what a lot of people are. That's why they go from one relationship to another. They want to have that again.
Someone's got to do the laundry eventually, right?
You know. Well,
that is kind of, you know. And I guess that's a question: is does anybody, you know, truly, you know, fall in love more than once, or are they ever trying to chase that if that first relationship doesn't work out?
I think certainly that weird experience I was describing can happen to a person more than once. It's happened to me more than once. But I think, you know, I think a lot of times we think of human beings as primarily rational creatures. But if you think about humans in an evolutionary sense, I think that the animalistic appetitive parts of us are much older. Reason is sort of the most recent immigrant to the human being, and so there's all these species related urges and desires that they're only geared to propagate and keep the species going. They don't care about the individual. Nature doesn't really care about the individual, and so I think what happens, it's kind of like reason is the recent immigrant to the human being, and so all those appetites and urges that they use and exploit reason for their purposes. One philosopher says reason is the slave of the passions. And so what happens, I think, is there's this philosopher, Schopenhauer, I mentioned before, who talks about these weird optical illusions that we experience. They're called Fata Morgana. I don't know if you've ever seen one, but they're these weird optical illusions where they usually happen on the sea or ocean or on a lake, big wide open spaces. And it's a weird thing, but you can see things like a ship off in the distance. It looks way bigger than it is. It might look upside down. There might be a right side up one and an upside down one on top of it. There's pictures of them. You can look them up. And so anyways, it seems like nature has equipped the human mind when it has some sort of need, like hunger, for example. I'm hungry. I need food to keep surviving. It magnifies and inflates the need to the point where I actually feel like my next meal is going to make me eternally happy or something like that. And that forces me to pursue it and get it so I can survive.
Does that mean I love food?
Well, I mean, in a sense, it's related to love because it's the same type of attraction. So if you think of the need to propagate the species, that's a need that nature has. So it inflates and magnifies with incredible intensity this object that can satisfy that need. But like Schopenhauer says, possession takes away the charm. Once the need's satisfied, you know, it's like you come out of a dream and you're like, oh, wait a minute. Why was I so obsessed with that meal? Or why was I so obsessed with that person, I guess, in some senses?
And certainly I would think as we get older, the process of the ability to love, the ability to understand what's happening to us, whether it is a romantic or otherwise, love of a child, love of a thing, love of oneself.
Very different things,
aren't they?
It's going
to change as we get older. I think in the younger, the teenage years, it is sort of that pursuit. And then once the pursuit is conquered or accomplished, it's like, oh, got her.
Yeah.
Move on to the next one.
I think the love of a parent for their child is similar in this way that, you know, parents really worry a lot about their children, I think, and their worries are magnified and inflated. You know, they're not reasonable worries most of the time, but there's like an innate need to preserve that child. And so the same type of thing happens with these Fata Morgana-like illusions, like, oh, no, my child is in danger, when really they just haven't called you yet or something like that.
That makes sense, because you try to argue that with a parent who would, you know, to their death say, no.
Yeah, it's too real. It's too real to deny.
So it is, Another thing that popped in my head, just what you were just saying a moment ago, the borderline between love and need to survive and you know, evolve and so on, and potential addiction, because it certainly sounds like what you're speaking of is walking that line a little bit.
Exactly, yeah.
When does it become...
When does it go sideways?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think
that's when it comes to even, you know, interpersonal relationships, you know, romantic love, things like that. It can.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think it probably. You know, I'm not an expert on psychology or, but I think it's probably, you know, an addiction to this moment where the magnified sense of my need will be fulfilled and I'll have eternal happiness if I get this thing. I think it's probably an addiction to that experience, because it's probably, if not the best experience in life, it's one of the most incredible experiences in life. So having it happen as much as possible would be wonderful. I think what a person feels when they take certain types of drugs is very similar to it too. It's euphoric. So their addiction would probably be connected to that, wanting to have it more.
Yeah. Ryan Scholer is joining us today, and he is a faculty member here at Henry Ford College in the philosophy department. And if you're enjoying this discussion, and we're certainly so happy to have you giving us this incredible detail, and if you like this type of talk, take a philosophy class from Ryan or some of the other very capable adjuncts. Tell us just briefly about what's happening here at Henry Ford College and how somebody can get involved and just learn more about these very interesting topics.
Sure. Well, the philosophy department here typically offers three main classes. We do introduction to logic, which is sort of the foundational, you know, rules of good inference and good reasoning. And then we do introduction to philosophy, where we approach sort of the typical classic problems of philosophy. And I'm actually, romantic love is one of those problems that I'm going to be pursuing with one of my classes this semester. And then we do also ethics, which is all about, you know, what exactly does it mean for an action to be good or bad, right or wrong? And philosophers have had plenty to say about that. We do have a couple other classes, a history of philosophy sequence and Eastern philosophy class that we offer periodically. But the first three are our staples.
Great.
How do other philosophies or other cultures handle these concepts? I mean, is this universal? I mean, can we say it's truly universal? Or?
Well, definitely. I mean, you know, Eastern philosophy is much, much older than Western. Western starts about 500 BC, and in the East it goes back another 1,500 years or 2,000 years. So most of the topics we talk about in the West have already finished talking about them before philosophy started in the West. So, you know, the setup and the rules of inference and the what we'd call the metaphysics in the East is a bit different. So it takes a lot to even, you know, sort of penetrate what they have to say. But love is certainly one of their main topics. Yes. And the dissatisfaction that human beings experience in life when they don't get things the way they want them.
So it's not so much just always looking at what you do have and how that affects you, but the void and how
right.
that can affect you as well.
Yeah, and how you react to the void or respond to it. Yeah, certainly.
Interesting. Well, in this week of love, we don't want to talk about the voids here at WHFR. We want to talk about the good stuff. So if we have somebody that's thinking, I really want to impress my special someone and quote some really cool philosophers on the subject of love and all that gushy, mushy stuff, what are your recommendations?
Well, I do have this quote from the French writer Stendhal that I think figures into this whole thing in a way that it's a bit ambiguous, so it could be taken different ways. But he said that beauty is nothing more than the promise of happiness, which is pretty deep. And I think it's connected to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, that you know, in life, when you're confronted with beauty, and that would include handsomeness on the other side, if you're talking about the masculine, it presents itself to you as capable of fulfilling all of your needs for happiness, right? So it does issue this promise. But I think that the question remains if that, you know, not all promises are kept. So it's possible that promise of happiness is an illusion and it won't be kept. But as a quote, I think it sounds pretty good. Mm-hmm. Beauty is nothing other than the promise of happiness. And so, yeah, you know, a lover could say that to his or her beloved.
Very nice.
It sounds pretty nice, I think.
I think so, too. Thank you.
There's always some sort of risk of love, right, in expressing love. I mean, you know, the safest bet, and I don't know my Greeks from my Romans, but, you know, the narcissism is, that's a pretty safe bet, right, if you can, you know, be at peace with yourself. But on the other hand, we generally want more, right?
Oh, certainly. And I think if you're honest, you have to admit that I think most of the elements that go into our concept of love are pretty self-focused. You know, what I can get for myself. But, you know, it's interesting, over the course of a relationship, people say I love you to one another for years, right? And I think they probably mean different things at different times in the course of that relationship. So in the beginning, when they say I love you, they might mean something like, I'm overwhelmed by your beauty and my obsession for you. I can't take it. I have to possess you. That might mean that. But then, you know, fast forward to year 10, I love you might mean, you know, you're my best friend and I'm in this committed relationship and I have no plans of leaving it. And then you fast forward another 10 years, it might mean,
this is a good business arrangement, and let's just keep it going for now, right?
Which is interesting, because I think the concept of romantic love is a pretty new one. For most of human history, it was an economic arrangement for most of it. But, you know, I saw a Valentine's card
I think my wife's teaching right now, so I can say I'm old school. Yeah.
I saw a Valentine card yesterday that the cover of it said, I tolerate you.
Oh, my goodness.
So I thought, you know, it's possible that in a relationship when a person says, I love you, they might mean something like that. It might, you know, evolve to mean, I'm still in this, or I still really like you, or you're still my best friend, plus... Right? Something
but
like that.
But then it may end up somewhere else, even after another 15 or 20 years,
sure,
as well.
Yeah.
When you look at people who have been, you know, together in a relationship, a loving relationship, for 40, 50, 60 years or something.
Sure. And I think it's possible that one of the elements of a long-term relationship is it's easier probably a lot of times to stay in it than leave it. And so I love you might just mean... I don't have the courage to not be in this anymore, which is a bit pessimistic, but it has to be true sometimes.
I'm in it for myself kind of thing, right?
Yeah. And it's interesting to me that the I often drops in the exchanges. We often say, love you, instead of I love you, because I think the I element of it is the most personal, and it's a lot easier to say love you than to say I love you. It's interesting. I don't know what exactly to make of that, but...
It is interesting.
It is interesting.
Yeah. Well, we're glad you kept your promise and stayed with us today. Really appreciate you coming in. If somebody wants to learn more about the classes that are offered through the philosophy department, or, you know, reach out to you directly to talk about some of the details of what's being offered, how can they reach you?
Well, certainly they can email me directly. My email's rshowler@hfcc.edu. That's rshowler@hfcc.edu. You can also find me on the employee directory on the school website. And, of course, if you look at the schedule of classes, it'll tell you what we have coming up in the schedule.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It was great.
Certainly. Our pleasure. We look forward to exploring more the topic of love as we continue this edition of the new WHFR Journal. Dr. Ryan Scholler, again, many thanks for being with us. And stay tuned. We do have so much more on the way.
Friend of mine, you seem to know me best. You chose me of the rest. Take me home with you and help me forget. Let's take the worst and somehow turn it into the best. Cause I know we're connected by love. Yes, I know we're connected.
back with more talk about love as the WHFR Journal continues in just a moment.
Lifelong Dearborn resident and HFC alumni, Gary Ciccarelli, has illustrated everything from posters of Elvis to U.S. Treasury bonds to Disney posters to superhero trading cards, video games, toy boxes, board games, cereal boxes, Star Wars books, and many other products have featured his artwork. See his personal favorites now through March 15th in the McKenzie Fine Arts Center's Sishin Art Gallery, located here on the Henry Ford College campus. For more information, including gallery hours, please visit sishin.hfcc.edu. That's sishon.hfcc.edu.
This is the WHFR Journal here at 89.3, online at WHFR.fm. I'm Alan Mazurek, and along with Susan McGraw, we're so glad to have you with us as we wrap up this Valentine's week. Try to provide some insight into the world of love. And love may very well be a many splendored thing, but it's also a pretty messy thing at times in our lives. It's not always the simplest thing to try to find a way to navigate. Luckily, we have science to help us out, I guess. And this is something that's well known in popular culture. It comes from a 1997 study that was done by social psychology researcher Arthur Aaron at Stony Brook University, who said that asking a stranger 36 questions and maintaining 4 minutes of eye contact with them is a surefire way to fall in love. This has been talked about. There's been magazine articles about it, newspaper articles. It was even referenced in an episode of the sitcom The Big Bang Theory. We're going to turn next to a TED Talk by Mandy Len Catron, who actually tried the experiment. She also wrote a column which was featured in the Modern Love segment of the New York Times, which obviously brought her a lot of attention. A TED Talk that was given in August of 2015 at TEDx at Chapman University out in California. Mandy Len Catron talking about falling in love is the easy part here on the WHFR Journal.
I published this article in the New York Times Modern Love column in January of this year. To fall in love with anyone, do this. And the article is about a psychological study designed to create romantic love in the laboratory. And my own experience trying the study myself one night last summer. So the procedure is fairly simple. Two strangers take turns asking each other 36 increasingly personal questions, and then they stare into each other's eyes without speaking for 4 minutes. So here are a couple of sample questions. Number 12, if you could wake up tomorrow having gained any one quality or ability, what would it be? Number 28, when did you last cry in front of another person or by yourself? As you can see, they really do get more personal as they go along. Number 30, I really like this one. Tell your partner what you like about them. Be very honest this time, saying things you might not say to someone you just met. So when I first came across this study a few years earlier, one detail really stuck out to me, and that was the rumor that two of the participants had gotten married 6 months later, and they'd invited the entire lab to the ceremony. So I was, of course, very skeptical about this process of just manufacturing romantic love, but of course I was intrigued. And when I got the chance to try the study myself, with someone I knew but not particularly well, I wasn't expecting to fall in love. But then we did, and and I thought it made a good story, so I sent it to the Modern Love column a few months later. Now, this was published in January, and now it is August, so I'm guessing that some of you are probably wondering, are we still together? And the reason I think you might be wondering this is because I have been asked this question again and again and again for the past 7 months. And this question is really what I want to talk about today. But let's come back to it. So the week before the article came out, I was very nervous. I had been working on a book about love stories for the past few years, so I had gotten used to writing about my own experiences with romantic love on my blog. But a blog post might get a couple hundred views at the most, and those were usually just my Facebook friends. And I figured my article in the New York Times would probably get a few thousand views. And that felt like a lot of attention on a relatively new relationship. But as it turned out, I had no idea. So the article was published online on a Friday evening, and by Saturday, this had happened to the traffic on my blog. And by Sunday, both the Today Show and Good Morning America had called. Within a month, the article would receive over 8 million views. And I was, to say the least, underprepared for this sort of attention. It's one thing to work up the confidence to write honestly about your experiences with love, but it is another thing to discover that your love life has made international news. And to realize that people across the world are genuinely invested in the status of your new relationship. And when people called or emailed, which they did every day for weeks, they always asked the same question first. Are you guys still together? In fact, as I was preparing this talk, I did a quick search of my email inbox for the phrase, are you still together? And several messages popped up immediately. They were from students and journalists and friendly strangers like this one. I did radio interviews and they asked. I even gave a talk and one woman shouted up to the stage, hey Mandy, where's your boyfriend? And I promptly turned bright red. I understand that this is part of the deal. If you write about your relationship in an international newspaper, you should expect people to feel comfortable asking about it. But I just wasn't prepared for the scope of the response. The 36 questions seemed to have taken on a life of their own. In fact, the New York Times published a follow-up article for Valentine's Day, which featured readers' experiences of trying the study themselves, with varying degrees of success. So my first impulse in the face of all this attention was to become very protective of my own relationship. I said no to every request for the two of us to do a media appearance together. I turned down TV interviews, and I said no to every request for photos of the two of us. I think I was afraid that we would become inadvertent icons for the process of falling in love, a position I did not at all feel qualified for. And I get it. People didn't just want to know if the study worked. They wanted to know if it really worked. That is, if it was capable of producing love that would last. Not just a fling, but real love, sustainable love. But this was a question I didn't feel capable of answering. My own relationship was only a few months old, and I felt like people were asking the wrong question in the first place. What would knowing whether or not we were still together really tell them? If the answer was no, would it make the experience of doing these 36 questions any less worthwhile? Dr. Arthur Aaron first wrote about these questions in this study here in 1997. And here, the researchers' goal was not to produce romantic love. Instead, they wanted to foster interpersonal closeness among college students by using what Aaron called sustained, escalating, reciprocal, personalistic self-disclosure. Sounds romantic, doesn't it? But the study did work. The participants did feel closer after doing it, and several subsequent studies have also used Aaron's fast friends protocol as a way to quickly create trust and intimacy between strangers, They've used it between members of the police and members of the community, and they've used it between people of opposing political ideologies. The original version of the story, the one that I tried last summer, that pairs the personal questions with 4 minutes of eye contact, was referenced in this article, but unfortunately, it was never published. So, a few months ago, I was giving a talk at a small liberal arts college, and a student came up to me afterwards, and he said, kind of shyly, "So, I tried your study, and it didn't work." He seemed a little mystified by this. "You mean you didn't fall in love with the person you did it with?" I asked. "Well," he paused, "I think she just wants to be friends." "But did you become better friends?" I asked. "Did you feel like you got to really know each other after doing the study?" He nodded. "So then it worked," I said. I don't think this is the answer he was looking for. In fact, I don't think this is the answer that any of us are looking for when it comes to love. I first came across this study when I was 29, and I was going through a really difficult breakup. I'd been in the relationship since I was 20, which is basically my entire adult life, and he was my first real love, and I had no idea how or if I could make a life without him. So I turned to science. I researched everything I could find about the science of romantic love, and I think I was hoping that it might somehow inoculate me from heartache. I don't know if I realized this at the time. I thought I was just doing research for this book I was writing, but it seems really obvious in retrospect. I hoped that if I armed myself with the knowledge of romantic love, I might never have to feel as terrible and lonely as I did then. And all this knowledge has been useful in some ways. I am more patient with love, I am more relaxed, I am more confident about asking for what I want. But I can also see myself more clearly, and I can see that what I want is sometimes more than can reasonably be asked for. What I want from love is a guarantee. Not just that I am loved today and that I will be loved tomorrow, but that I will continue to be loved by the person I love indefinitely. And maybe it's this possibility of a guarantee that people were really asking about when they wanted to know if we were still together. So the story that the media told about the 36 questions was that there might be a shortcut to falling in love. There might be a way to somehow mitigate some of the risk involved. And this is a very appealing story because falling in love feels amazing, but it's also terrifying. The moment you admit to loving someone, you admit to having a lot to lose. And it's true that these questions do provide a mechanism for getting to know someone quickly, which is also a mechanism for being known. And I think this is the thing that most of us really want from love: to be known, to be seen, to be understood. But I think when it comes to love, we are too willing to accept the short version of the story. The version of the story that asks, "Are you still together?" and is content with a yes or no answer. So rather than that question, I propose we ask some more difficult questions. Questions like, how do you decide who deserves your love and who does not? How do you stay in love when things get difficult? And how do you know when to just cut and run? How do you live with the doubt that inevitably creeps into every relationship? Or even harder, how do you live with your partner's doubt? I don't necessarily know the answers to these questions, but I think they're an important start at having a more thoughtful conversation about what it means to love someone. So, if you want it, the short version of the story of my relationship is this. A year ago, an acquaintance and I did a study designed to create romantic love, and we fell in love, and we are still together, and I am so glad. But falling in love is not the same thing as staying in love. falling in love is the easy part. So at the end of my article, I wrote, love didn't happen to us. We're in love because we each made the choice to be. And I cringe a little when I read that now. Not because it isn't true, but because at the time, I really hadn't considered everything that was contained in that choice. I didn't consider how many times we would each have to make that choice, and how many times I will continue to have to make that choice without knowing whether or not he will always choose me. I want it to be enough to have asked and answered 36 questions, and to have chosen to love someone so generous and kind and fun, and to have broadcast that choice in the biggest newspaper in America. But what I have done instead is turn my relationship into the kind of myth I don't quite believe in. And what I want, what perhaps I will spend my life wanting, is for that myth to be true. I want the happy ending implied by the title to my article, which is, incidentally, the only part of the article that I didn't actually write. But what I have instead is the chance to make the choice to love someone and the hope that he will choose to love me back. And it is terrifying. But that's the deal with love. Thank you.
Mandy Len Ketron and her TED Talk, Falling in Love is the Easy Part, featured on TED.com. It was a talk that was given in August of 2015 at TEDx at Chapman University out in California. Mandy Len Ketron explores love stories and wrote a book called How to Fall in Love with Anyone, which was published by Simon & Schuster in 2017. I'm Alan Mazurek. Thank you so much for spending your Friday afternoon, or at least part of us, with us here at the WHFR Journal. We do hope you have a great weekend, and we hope to see you back here next Friday at 1 o'clock as we explore other topics of interest to the community and the world at large, along with Susan McGraw. Kitty Love's going to be up next. Highway 61 is where we're headed here on the station Making Waves, WHFR.
Hi, this is Jumper, the host of Cruising and Bluesing in the Nighttime. Every Wednesday night, 9 p.m. till 1 a.m., we're doing our thing on that blues plane. Tune us in right here on WHFR 89.3.
Baby, baby, please. I'm begging you, baby. Baby, please. Turn on the light. Let it shine on me. Turn on your love light. Let it shine on me.
Listener supported. Non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Featuring local and independent artists.